I was watching a fascinating discussion between Jordan Peterson and Warren Farrell the other day about roughhousing. That's about how this traditional play between a father and his children influences child development. Mothers often don't understand why children need this type of play. It's not normally the way women interact with children, and often makes us really nervous watching dad throw the baby in the air or act like a scary monster, sending children wild with fright and delight. My older son is living in Texas with his family at the moment, and just around the time this video came out, they sent through a few videos of my son playing with his baby girl. They so beautifully captured what Peterson and Farrell were talking about that I thought you might enjoy seeing them. Here's Jesse with his daughter Matilda.
Is that what happens, little strawberry blonde?
Isn't that wonderful? Roughhousing is just one of many reasons why children need fathers. They offer something very special. So here's Jordan Peterson and Warren Farrell to tell you all about it, discussing findings outlined in Warren's new book, The Boy Crisis, which I discussed with him in a recent video. I thought it'd be nice to make a video about something positive after all the worrying issues I've been focusing on recently. Enjoy.
So you laid out a whole slew of reasons, a slew of consequences of fatherlessness. And we'll return back to the causal relationship between what men do and these beneficial outcomes. But if you could go on now to tell us what it is that men are doing at a micro level, then we could return to the causal link between that and the positive outcomes. And you said those also cause some contention in the household.
Yes. Yeah. I'll give one example. For example, will be, a father is roughhousing with the kids.
Yeah.
And the mom's looking over and saying, looking askance and thinking, okay, when should I interfere? When should I not interfere? And the mom's saying to herself, Jimmy, please keep the kids away from the credenza there. Keep the kids away from the couch because they could hit their head there. Why don't you wait, hubby, to tomorrow when you can take this outside? I feel much safer with the kids. And then the mother is sort of hesitating to not be overly controlling, and yet at the same time she's feeling she has to monitor the husband as well as monitor the husband with the kids. And she's feeling in the back of her mind like, sooner or later there's going to be an accident here, and I'm going to be upset with myself for not being stricter. But on the other hand, the kids seem to be having fun, so I should let things go.
Well, you know, there's a psychobiologist named Jaak Panksepp, who's one of the world's great biological psychologists, and he studied rough and tumble play in animals. Mm-hmm. So rats, for example, a huge part of the socialization process that's key to the development of the prefrontal cortex in juvenile male rats in particular emerges and matures as a consequence of rough and tumble play. And one of the amazing things that Panksepp discovered, and this truly is an amazing thing, is that if you pair two rats together and then let them play repeated bouts, the big rat will dominate the little rat to begin with in the first bout. But if the big rat doesn't let the little rat win about 30% of the time in repeated play bouts, then the little rat won't play anymore. So you get an emergent morality, an emergent play-centered morality, even among rats as a consequence of rough and tumble play. And that rough and tumble, I did a fair bit of research on rough and tumble play about 15 years ago. And it's really quite clear that rough and tumble play helps children parameterize their bodies so that they know how they extend and also what limits there is in the use of physical interactions with another person. What's fun? What's provocative? What's pushing it too far? What's painful? And of course, kids love rough and tumble play as well. They're just absolutely starving for it. And we've squeezed it out of the kindergartens, the nursery schools, the elementary schools, the junior high schools, all of that and forbid. And what Panksepp also found was that if you deprived juvenile rats of the opportunity to engage in active rough and tumble play, that they showed symptoms that were broadly analogous to those of attention deficit disorder in human boys, and that you could also treat that with Ritalin the same way in rats as you could with boys. Yes. So there's that rough and tumble play issue. You know, and you might think too, the question is, one question is, why might a mother be distrustful of the rough and tumble play episode? And some of that might be sensitivity with regards to the kids, but huge part of that also is trust on her trust with regards to the father, you know, because it's rambunctious and noisy. And if she trusts, let's say that active masculinity that plays rough, then she'll stay away and let the fun happen. But if there's distrust running through the family, then she'll stand between the kids and the father, and then he won't get to involve himself in that way. And then he'll turn off. And I've seen that happen in many, many families. Okay, so there's rough and tumble play. That's a big one. What else do you see?
Let me take the evolution of how rough and tumble play goes and all the dimensions of where the slippery slope that it leads to. So what neither the mom nor the dad know is that this rough and tumble play leads to the types of things that you just mentioned, which are also evident in, you know, in elephants and so on.
Yeah.
But it also leads to the distinction between a child being able to distinguish between being assertive versus aggressive. So the kid starts, for example, maybe kicking the dad in the wrong place, or poking the dad in the eyes, or pulling the dad's hair, and the dad says, sweetie, you can fake eye contact to the left and then move to the right to win in this wrestling match. Or you can, you can do this, this, and this, but you can't do these things.
Yeah.
And if you do these things, we'll stop the roughhousing.
Yeah. So there's a really important issue there. So two things there. So imagine that a rough and tumble bout is like a dance. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the point of the dance is so that both people are having a good time while it's happening.
Yes.
Because otherwise it's not play, right? And as soon as either party is no longer having a good time, you've actually snapped out of the psychobiological function of the play circuit. Yeah. So basically what you're telling the child by putting those rules on is we can interact physically within a very limited set of parameters. And what you have to learn to do is to be a sophisticated player within that set of parameters. And you want to learn how to push the boundaries, right? Because the most fun rough and tumble play is right on the edge between assertiveness and aggression.
Right.
So, and you can see kids, like I used to work in daycare centers when I was a kid, when I was 18, 19, and the kids would line up to rough and tumble play with me because that was still allowable then, and they were so desperate for it, it was just ridiculous. And I could really tell the difference between the kids who had engaged in that sort of play and the ones that hadn't. And the ones that hadn't were painfully awkward. And they would hurt themselves and you when you wrestled with them. They'd put their thumb in your eye, and they would cry often too when they got surprised, but not hurt. You know, because they couldn't tell the difference between just being startled and being hurt. And so they were fragile, and that also made them not fun to play with. And the thing that's so interesting about that too is that Piaget talked about this when he talked about the development of children, is that, you know, the more sophisticated pretend play and then sophisticated cognitive play that emerges, say, between 5 and 7, and then with the cognitive play older than that, is that unless you have that underlying psychomotor embodied dance down, you don't get to really proceed in a sophisticated way to those higher levels of play, because other people don't want to play with you. So the rough and tumble play, the importance of that can hardly be overstated. So
absolutely. And the framework here is that when you've set up a system where you've said that, you know, men are part of the patriarchy, their desire is to dominate women and make rules to benefit men at the expense of women, you have a framework, an emotional setting, which is not conducive to men saying, here's my value, or women saying, let me see what the checks and balances of parenting is that leads to the best of you coming out and the best of me coming out. All of that has sort of, we've skipped over an inherent sense of father knows best to father knows less. And so the, the process that I'll be sharing in a moment of what roughhousing leads to, and the slippery slope that happens when it doesn't happen, is what has not even been nurtured as a possibility to be articulated in this culture at this time.
I also think too, you know, that if you have a partner who hasn't been played with, then that partner can't tell the difference between boisterous rambunctiousness and aggression. And if there's a hypothesis about domination and the patriarchy running its course underneath that, then there's going to be conceptual confusion about the physical interactions that have the appearance of submission and dominance, because that's part of the roughhousing play routine. It's going to, that is going to be viewed through a lens of tyrannical interaction rather than just good fun. And I mean, you can tell the difference, because if the kids are rough and tumble playing, they're unbelievably enthusiastic about it and engaged and laughing and giggling, and like, they'll play right to the point of exhaustion because they need it. They need it so much. But that's a hard thing to observe from the outside if you're not accustomed to that.
And if you don't have that framework of men having and dads having a value to begin with, absolutely not. So here's maybe what might be helpful for a mom to understand. That the rough and tumble play we now know helps children distinguish between being assertive and aggressive, but a number of other things also happen during that play, which is a bond that is created between the father and the child. And in almost every, in doing expert witness work to help children have both parents after divorce, I've observed more than 50 families and usually the father interacting with the children. And in almost every case, actually, I believe that I have seen, there's this bond is used by the father to say things like, okay, we're no more roughhousing now. Tell you what, you get your homework done, you get your chores done, you get all ready for bed, brush teeth, brush well. And, the bedtime is 9 o'clock. Whenever you get all that done, we'll have between the time you get it done and the time of 9 o'clock. In order for you to have some more fun, either with roughhousing or reading your favorite story, or whatever you prefer. It's your choice.
Well, you know, with Panksepp's work too, he found that the rats will work to enter a play arena. Because play, you think play is a, so Panksepp established very, very clearly that there is a primary play circuit in mammals. It's a separate psychobiological circuit. It's not exploration. It's a whole different motivational drive. But that activity in that circuit is intrinsically pleasurable. And part of that appears to be because it's so key to proper socialization that it's regarded by children and by social mammals as intrinsically valuable. And so it makes perfect sense that that can be used as a source of primary reward. And I think your comments about the man and the kids binding themselves together through play is also really important, because one of the things that I do with young men who, you know, I think young men tend to be somewhat alienated from infants who are under about 9 months old, because they're not really equipped to know what the hell to do with them. I mean, they can learn and they can be good at it, but it's not their domain of natural expertise. But once a kid hits about 9 months and starts to be able to imitate and to pound and to play and to respond to gentle teasing, like, that's a perfect time for the father to swoop in, which is very helpful for a mother, by the way, who wants to have another child, and to start really cementing a relationship that's based on that interesting combination of high energy fun plus the disciplined interactions that are necessary as a precursor to that. And if you interfere with that, then you stop the father from being able to form that, from liking his kids, really. You know, because that's how the liking comes about, is through play. And so it's crucial. It's of crucial significance.
Absolutely. And thank you. The additional framework that you're placing on this is really deepening my own understanding of it as well.
Yeah, well, there's a book called Affective Neuroscience, written by Jack Panksepp. It's on my reading list on my website. And I would highly recommend that, because he lays out the findings from the animal literature on the primary play circuit. It's really, he should have won a Nobel Prize for it. I mean, discovering an entirely new motivational system in the brain is
a major, major contribution. And to also, the other thing that he did that was so cool and sort of reminded me of Jean Piaget's work a little bit, is he made a very strong case that out of play emerges an ethic. And, you know, that's why I was so interested when you mentioned that
interactions with father actually increase empathy. Because, you know, if someone has empathy for you, that means that, I mean, that can lead to a certain kind of narcissism, right? Because you're always the center of attention. You're not empathic unless you learn to, that you're not any more important than the next person, particularly the person that you happen to be playing with. So, okay, so let's continue with what fathers are doing.
In that rough housing, let's see one of the things you've been talking about.
Yep.
So in that rough housing, what happens is that the bond that is created by the dad allows the dad to say, you've got, you know, here's, we'll continue the rough housing if you get, you know, between 8:30 and 9, if you have everything done. But so the child learns to postpone gratification from doing the, what it loves to do right then and there, that is be roughhoused with and deal with what it has to deal with before it gets more of what it needs. And so, but the bond.
So that's interesting. So you actually think, and I wonder if there's been any, see, we don't know much about the origin of the trait conscientiousness, which is at least in part the ability to delay gratification. And it is, after intelligence, it's the best predictor of long-term life success, especially in managerial and administrative jobs, in algorithmic jobs. It's not associated with creativity, but that's a side issue. So your hypothesis is that the primary way men are socializing that is by using work to play as a bridge.
Yes, that play creates a bond. So a lot of the problem is when moms often say, you know, you have to do this, you have to do that, you have to do this, you have to do that. The mother is often experienced by the child as sort of the disciplinarian who's always making him or her do things. And there's a seeds of rebellion start to occur of sort of like, how much am I going to be myself? How much am I going to do what mom does? Do I want to be a mama's boy? Or it doesn't even happen consciously, but you know, you just sort of feel like you're being pushed down by all the rules. But with dad, the bond that is, or moms who roughhouse with the children, a bond is created. And from that, and you want to return to that connection. So it's like a child going on a roller coaster where you know there's an enormous amount of safety, but you also, excitement, but also an enormous amount of safety. And so you trust the dad to combine that both, and you want to return to that. So you're willing to focus on getting done what you need to do, your homework, your chores, your brush your teeth or whatever, in order to get what you want to do, which is the, you know, right, form of postponed gratification. But now let's take the slippery slope when this doesn't happen. So,
okay, so let me just add one more thing to that. Well, the thing that's so cool about that is that you've also provided a really intelligent piece of parenting advice for fathers. It's like, because so let's say B.F. Skinner, who was the famous animal behaviorist, demonstrated quite clearly that you could train animals with reward more effectively than with threat or punishment. Now, threat or punishment is necessary. Obviously, we wouldn't have biological systems subserving those emotions if they weren't necessary. But reward is harder to use because you have to be much more attentive and intervene when something good happens. And so you really have to be watching. But your hypothesis here is, look, fathers, spend a bunch of time playing with your kids and having as much fun as you can with them, because by formulating that bond, you can use that as the source of reward that will be appreciated by the child with regards to disciplinary strategies. So it's a twofold victory. One is it's fun and you get to like your kids and have a good time with them. But the second is you have a very positive means of disciplining them in the best sense, encouraging them and disciplining them. So that's a really useful thing to know practically.
So deepening the trust of the kids, like you're playing and you're right on the edge that you were talking about, but there's dad to make sure that the fun doesn't get too hard for you, for him, for your sister and so on. And so that's all happening at the same time. Now when the—
Right. And that's embodied. You can see that two ways. That's embodied trust. So if you toss a little kid up in the air and catch them, I mean, it's very exciting to them, both being tossed up because of the threat, but then the relief that occurs because of the safety that's put in there. So it's not abstract. It's really demonstrated. And then—
Absolutely. Our dad tossing that child up and then in fact missing the child, quote unquote, and the child lands on the bed and it gets enormous, like, oh, yeah, I was missed. So you were going to catch me, but you know, also recognize.
Yes. Well, that shows that things can happen that aren't entirely what you predict, but within the confines of a trusting relationship, that's still okay. And then you could also imagine if the dad is wrestling with more than one kid at the same time, then he's also acting as just referee. right? So, and then the kids learn how to be judicious in the distribution of attention. They learn how to play fair. They learn how everybody can have a turn and everybody wins at the same time. And so,
exactly right. Mm-hmm. And that bonding is what is part of what creates, and just everything you just said is part of what leads the child to have empathy training. And the empathy training came from, no, you were too rough on your sister there. If you try it again, you can't be that rough. Oh, you still continue to be that rough? Okay, let's.
No more play. That's right. Play stops when everyone isn't having fun. When my kids were little, we had this couch that was a sectional in six pieces. And so we could put the couches facing each other, and then we put up the backs all the way around it. So it was like a little wrestling ring. And so then I would take the kids in there and just wrestle them half to death, you know. But one of the things I used to do was if one of the kids was rough with the other and made them cry, then I noticed that the kid who made the other kid cry wouldn't look at the crying kid. They'd look away and avoid. And so I always used to say, no, you look. You look and you see what happened, because that triggers that embodied empathy. And then you can easily have a conversation and say, look, you know, is that how you want the game to go? Or do you want everybody to have fun? And the thing is, once the kid actually looks, then they've got it, right? Because they can't escape from that empathic identification. And so, yeah.
When the child doesn't have that, you know, so we have all this data now, these 70 different areas where children do so much worse when they don't have a father involvement. So let's look at the next stage of that. When that father does not do this roughhousing, and as just one example of many, and is not enforcing boundaries, the child then doesn't learn to have that postponed gratification. So we have hard data on this. Children raised predominantly by dads are only 15% likely to have ADHD. Children raised predominantly by moms are 30% likely to have ADHD. So if we looked at what we just talked about, the children that are raised by the dads are learning that they have to postpone that gratification in order to get the reward that they want. Now you take that capacity to postpone gratification to school. The child without postponed gratification, assigned a homework assignment, doesn't really feel, is oftentimes distracted by a text that's come in, distracted by the opportunity to play video games, distracted by wanting to exchange notes with other kids, is distracted.
Sure. The distraction thing about there's no need to explain ADHD. What there is a need to do is to explain why every kid doesn't have it. And the answer that you just laid out is that some kids learn how to control their distractibility doesn't require an explanation, because people are distracted by what's immediately rewarding. And that doesn't require it's like addiction. Actually, addiction doesn't require explanation either. What requires explanation is the development of the resources that allow you to withstand addictive pressures in the face of the fact that they're everywhere and they're powerful. So it's development of control that's really the curious issue. And yes. I've never heard anyone make this connection between the use of play as a reward and that delay of gratification. That's a very, very interesting idea.